first few minutes.
We get a block structure with a zero block in the lower left corner. Okay. Right, if you now look back at what you did in linear algebra, this would be 1 by 1. Blocks would be just 1 by 1 because we have single vectors. And we would have a matrix then possibly in upper triangular form. And if you look at what can happen there, we have the eigenvectors, and the nice situation is that I can find a basis of eigenvectors. And in some cases I can, but in general I cannot, right? If we pick, for example, this matrix here over the rationals, this has no basis of eigenvectors. Or I should properly say, Q2 has no basis of eigenvectors of this matrix, right? Because the eigenvalue is 1, that's the only eigenvalue there. If there was a basis of eigenvectors, I could find a basis with respect to which this matrix would be the identity matrix, right? It would be a block 1 here and another block 1. But if I have the identity matrix, regardless what base change I'm doing, it stays the identity matrix, and that is not. So that's in some way the fundamental obstacle, one of the things which makes linear algebra more complicated, and why one needs to go to things like Jordan canonical form or other canonical forms, and why there is more happening. Well, if we are working with finite groups, so can something, basically I want to show you something like this will not happen for finite groups. And the observation here is, if we do this over the rationals, what would be the order of this matrix if I look at it multiplicatively? What happens if I square this? This is my matrix A. What is A squared? Well, if you multiply, trust you to multiply this out, and A cubed gets a 3 here, and so forth. So actually, we can generalize from 2 to n. We get this. So clearly, this matrix now, if the field is infinite, if this can grow arbitrarily, this matrix has infinite order. And one can show that this is really the case. Indeed, the proof actually I'll give you will show that this holds for matrices as special case of cyclic groups. If we have finite groups, the behavior is much nicer. We don't really need to deal with a situation that we have, where the analog would be, we don't have enough eigenvectors, that we have a structure which is more complicated. But what we can do is we can always find a basis. If there is a submodule, we can find a basis where we also have zero here. And that's what I want to do next. Right. One can describe this more formally by talking about a direct sum of submodules, but probably we don't really need to go towards all that language. So this is, and this is actually theorem 1 in this book. And this typically goes under the name of Maschke's theorem. Okay, so let's suppose, let rho from G to the general linear group of some vector space be a linear representation. And let's assume we have a subspace of V which is left fixed by rho of G, and W a subspace of V that is stable under G. So we have exactly this situation. If I choose a basis, starting with basis vectors for the subspace, all the matrices have this form. And what this theorem claims is, then there exists another subspace, which is also stable, and he calls this W0, another subspace of V, such that W0 and W intersect just in the zero vector, and together they generate the whole space. So that's the situation that I could say V is the direct sum as subspaces of W and W0. And what does this mean for matrices? Well, if I now choose a basis for V, which consists of a basis for W and a basis for W0, just concatenated, right? Then I can do this. I choose, if they intersect trivially, well, you might need the theorem. You need the theorem about dimension of intersection and closure that they are related. Is that obviously in an undergraduate? There might be a small statement about linear algebra which you have not seen here. But in that situation, we can choose a basis for both subspaces and concatenate it and get a basis for the whole space. So that means with respect to a basis for V, that is concatenation. Basis for W and a basis for W0, all the matrices for rho of G have the form I have something here. And I don't just have the zero here because of W, but I also have a zero here, right? My basis vectors for W0, they are the last basis vectors. If I take one of these, and so these columns here describe the images of the basis vectors for W0, well, the images lie again in W0. That's what I claim. It's stable under the group action. So they lie in W0, so they must be linear combinations of the last few basis vectors, the basis vectors for W0, and that means there must be zeros up here. And so what is happening is actually that unless I'm somehow unlucky in choosing my basis, really the representation is, if I have a sub-representation, the whole representation is just a direct sum of these two sub-representations. There is nothing in this upper right corner which does some mixing. Or I don't have the behavior as in linear algebra when I look at eigenvectors of general matrices, that I would not have a basis of eigenvectors, that I need to deal with these cases. And that's in some way quite nice property. So right. So that's what that theorem I want to prove. Is the statement clear what I'm... Yeah.
Yeah. Would you say then that in linear algebra when we do have sort of mixing of the spaces, is that sort of a property of infinite dimensional... that there's...
No, it's not even this. It's finite dimension. It's a...
I know, but like in linear
algebra,
when we do have... Never mind.
So
the field that we're working over is infinite. Is what you're saying?
It's some way that it's infinite order. Actually, what we need is basically, it's not really the infinite. What one needs and one could state it in that form is that the group order or the orders. Somehow it doesn't matter if you take the orders of all elements, are invertible in the field where we are working. So it would also, the theorem holds, if I take the group S3, which has order 6, and I'm working modulo 5, the same thing would still hold. But if I take S3 and I'm working modulo 2, it does not necessarily. So that's really where things can go wrong. And in some way you could say here that it goes wrong because I have characteristic zero and order infinity. And there you need to argue that zero and infinity in a certain sense are the same thing. Now, in the slight stretch of imagination. Okay. Right, so that theorem I want to prove. And what I need to do is basically just, I need to find, given W, I need to find W0. Right. So, let's prove this. And what I'm going to do is, I will first, what I need is a subspace, and I want that this subspace is stable under the action. To find another subspace is not hard. If I have one subspace, to find another subspace such that these properties hold, that is very easy. You just take a basis for your subspace, you extend it to a basis of the new space, you take the basis vectors which were new, and you take the space spent by these new basis vectors. That's easy linear algebra. The hard bit really is, or the important part of the statement is that this is again stable under the group. So that's... what I'm going... to do. Okay. Right. So, do I? So, let P be a projection from, and the projection as a linear transformation. I don't say anything here about invariants. Linear transformation from V to W. So what do I mean by this? I take the basis vectors. What will happen? Can I describe such a projection? I choose W prime such that V is the direct sum of W and W prime as vector space. So W prime, I don't assume that it is stable. And what I do is I map W to W, and I map W prime to the zero, everything to or to the space of the zero vector. So I have the identity on W and the everything else is mapped to zero. So if I choose my basis adapted to this, the matrix for this projection is simply a identity matrix which at some point be it just doesn't have ones but zero, where I zero out after a certain number of vectors. That's the projection on this subspace. Okay. And what I'm now going to do is I will look at images of this projection under the group action. Okay. What do I mean by this? If I have a group of symmetries acting on some space, and I have a function which goes into that space, or I look at the set of functions which go into this space, the group also will act on the set of these functions. Namely, how will it act on the set of these functions? I can actually choose two different ways how it can act. No, sorry, if it goes in the set of functions, then it will act simply by acting on the images. So I map a function f of x. My new function will not have the image f of x, but f of x and then image under the group action. Right? My function initially gives me some graph here, and now I say I have my symmetry is rotation, then I want to have this image here. Okay. So I can act on functions. Or if I have functions from some set on which a group acts to somewhere else, the group will also act on the functions. Namely, then I first apply the symmetry to the argument and then map the function. So let's say, again, I have some sine function which goes from the real axis, from the real numbers to, the real numbers, but yeah, I have this graph. Now I take a symmetry of my arguments and I replace x by minus x. Then I get this function, which happens to be minus sine, but it's really sine of minus x. Okay, so I can do these two things. And to make it consistent, there is one place where we need to take inverses so that things behave nicely under composition. And I'm doing both. So P is a function from V to W, and the group acts on V because V was, we have a homomorphism from G to the general linear group of V. And P also acts on W because W was stable, G acts on W because W was stable under G. So I can have G act in two ways on such projections, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing both actions, and I'm taking the average. Each of these gives me some projection, and I'm taking the average of these projections. And what will happen is that by taking this average, that will make it invariant, and in a certain way invariant under the group. Okay, so that's the battle plan for proving. So let P0 be 1 over the order of G, and now I'm summing over all elements in the group. Okay, so here I'm using that the group is finite, because otherwise I have an infinite sum, and then I would need to first justify what I mean by some infinite sum of functions. Okay, but we have finite, we're good. And I'm dividing by the group order. I can always do this over the complex numbers. My group order is not zero. But if I was working over a finite field, I would have to be careful here. So that's where both of these things come in. Okay. And now I'm taking rho t dot p dot rho t inverse. And what do I mean by rho t? By rho t, I mean rho of t. It's just slightly shorter to write this way to avoid covering it all with parentheses. So this really should be rho of t. It's the linear transformation which is associated
to the element t. So, right. Okay. Yeah, so what does this function, what does it do? Well, I need to sum, if I want to calculate the image of some vector, well, I get this sum here, but if I look at a single summand, I take that vector, map it under rho of t inverse, right? Rho of t is a linear transformation, an invertible one. I take the inverse of this transformation, map to p, map with p, and then map under rho of t. And because, okay, this will map from v to v, this will map from now from v to w, and once I'm in w, because w is stable, even if I map it further, I stay in w. And if I sum it up, I still stay in w. Right? So this is a linear transformation. Formation which goes from V to W. Okay. Next I want to see what does it actually do on W. If I feed in a vector which is already in W. Well, if I put in, let's look at one of these terms. So, note that if I have a vector little w in W and I calculate rho t dot p dot rho t inverse and I apply this to this vector W. Okay? Yeah? So, what will happen here? Well, I have this vector W, I apply rho t inverse and this gives me something else in W. Right? So this here lies in W because W is stable. That means that what this projection P does is nothing to it. The projection is the identity on W, so I can forget what this does. Okay, and once I don't have this projection there, I have rho T inverse and rho T, and they are inverse operations. So I can also cancel these two here, and I get W. So, what is P0 of W? P0 of W is 1 over the order of G, sum over T in G, W. Well, here this argument doesn't depend on T. So this is just the order of g times w. And that's why I have this denominator here, that this will cancel with this, and I just get w itself. So p is not only a linear transformation, but it's the identity on w. So let's note this now. P goes from V to W is a linear transformation.
Yes.
So the image of, oh, sorry, of P0 lies in W.
I was curious, I didn't know what kind of file it was.
Then on W, P0 is the identity. That tells me that W is the full image of P0, right? Before it could have been that the image is somehow smaller, but that it really, P0 doesn't just map into W, it maps onto W. Every vector in W can be obtained, namely as image of itself. And that tell together tells me that P0 is a projection. P0 is a projection. And what do I mean by this? I mean by this there exists that V is the direct sum of W with the kernel of P0. Okay. And what am I using there? Since I have finite dimensional vector spaces, this is basically just the theorem about dimensions of kernel and image of a linear transformation. Right? Dimension of the whole space is dimension of the kernel of the transformation plus dimension of the image. Here the transformation goes from the space to a subspace. So the kernel must exactly have the dimension of V minus dimension of W. And because it's the identity of W, they can't intersect. Nothing of W can lie in the kernel. Right? Anything which lies in the kernel is mapped to zero, but anything which lies in W is mapped to itself, so W and the kernel must intersect trivially. And that's just the slick way of saying it, the vector space is a direct sum of subspaces. And then the dimension argument tells you not only do they intersect trivially, but then together they must generate. Because if they intersect trivially, the dimension of what they generate together is just the sum of the dimensions. Okay, so I have this situation, and this kernel of P0, that's what I will call W0. Right, so let W0 be the kernel of P0, and that is certainly a subspace. Okay, so in some way I had already another subspace here, this subspace W prime, where I had a direct sum, I now have W0. Why does this help me? Because now I can show that W0 is invariant under the group action. And that's all what I had to show, right? I just having another subspace, and we saw before, that is not a big thing. That happens automatically. The important thing is that this other subspace is stable. So, then W0 is stable under the group action. And it is stable basically because I involved the group here. So what I just need to show is that if something lies in W0 and I act on it with a group, it is again in W0, right? And how can I test that it is in W0? By applying P0 to it and showing that the image is zero, right? So, let's show this. So let little w be an element of W0, and let little g be an element of my group G. And what I want to do is, I want to show that rho g of W lies W0, right? But once I've shown this, I know it is invariant. That's the definition of invariant. And how do I show this? I show this by calculating P0 of rho g of W is the zero vector, because W0 is the kernel of P0. Okay, right. So that's what I want to show. How do I show this? Well, I basically just look, what does P0 do?
Well, this is 1 over the order of g. And now I don't really need the denominator. The only reason where I need this 1 over the order of g is to make sure that it's the identity on w so that it is a projection and I have this direct sum decomposition. So, sum over t in g. Okay, now I have rho t times b times rho t inverse, and that gets applied to rho g, and I apply this to w. Okay, and now comes one of the standard, well, no, let's do first one other thing. So here I have rho t inverse. Well, rho is a homomorphism. The homomorphic image of an inverse is the inverse of the image. Homomorphisms behave nicely with inverses. So instead of taking rho t inverse, I could also have chosen rho t inverse. So that is rho t inverse is the same as rho t inverse. That's just saying rho is a homomorphism. Okay? Right, and now I have rho of something and rho of something. Rho is a homomorphism. Homomorphisms behave nicely with products. Oh, yes, red chocolate. So, this together is rho of t inverse times g. Okay. And now I will observe that if t runs through all elements of the group, t inverse runs through all elements of the group, and t inverse times g for a fixed g also runs through all elements of the group. If I take all elements of the group and I multiply them with a fixed element g, I'm just mixing them around. But the element just permutes the elements of the group. So let's give a new name to this. Let's call t inverse g. Let's say this is, no, k I had before, I think it's number. I call it s. It's a letter close to t. Yeah. So I want this to be s inverse. And what does s have to be? S would be g inverse times t. Okay? If I said S is equal to G inverse times T, then S inverse is T inverse times G. Okay. And I can also, in this case, describe what is T. I can solve this for T. T is G times S. Right? Okay. And I said multiplication with G permutes just the elements of the group, or multiplication with G inverse permutes the elements of the group. So I now do an index change. Instead of summing over T, I'm summing over the S's. And it's a finite sum. That's where I need finite. I can reorder it without worrying. I change my summation order. So this is 1 over the order of g, sum over s in g. Okay, and what do I get now here? I get, okay, rho t is, t was g times s. So I get rho g times s times p times rho s applied to this vector w. Okay? Well, what is rho gs? Rho is a homomorphism, so this is rho g and then rho s. Right? And rho g is a linear transformation. So if I apply, if I have the same linear transformation rho g here under a sum and after a scaling factor, I can pull that out because it is a linear transformation. So this is, well, that's right. Yeah, let's keep that here. So we just remember what P0 is. So this is rho G applied to 1 over the order of G, sum over little s in G, rho S times P times rho S inverse, and that whole thing applies to the vector W. Okay. And what is this here? Well, I should have drawn it here. That is up to how I call my variable, and that really doesn't matter, is just P0, right? So what I have seen is basically by this reindexing, or as a consequence of this averaging process, I have been able to move this rho g to past all these other functions. And that is something which one can generally do if you have a group action. If you have a group acting on something, you take, let's say, finite group, take a set of all images and you sum up these images, or you take the collection of these images, so that is this collection or this sum or so is something which is invariant under the group, which where the group doesn't do something, and it's the same idea here. I'm acting on the functions with the group. I'm taking the average here, and that is something which is invariant under the group. But now, let's calculate. What is this? I have P0 of W. Well, W was in W0, which was the kernel of P0. So that here is 0. So that's rho g of the 0 vector. And rho g is a linear transformation, so it can't do anything but map this to 0. So I have seen my vector W must lie in the curve, lies in the curve, W0. That's all I had to show. So W0 is fixed under the group action. And that proves the theorem. Okay. Right. And what do we get of this as a consequence? As a consequence, that's basically what I said at the start as a motivation. Every irreducible representation, every representation, if V is a vector space on which G acts, if there is a sub-representation, I will find such a complement that I can write V as a direct sum. So every representation is a direct sum of irreducible subrepresentations. And of course here the assumption is I'm working with finite groups over the complex numbers. Otherwise this is wrong. Or in characteristics, well, I need characteristics zero. Otherwise this is wrong. Every representation, so I have finite group and I have characteristics zero, is a direct sum of irreducible sub representations. Well, and that means that if I know the irreducible representations, I know all of them. Yes, I described last time, I can write in down infinitely many ones. But indeed, not just as in these toy examples I gave you where I said map to an identity matrix which gets arbitrarily large. That's really all what happens. The only things which are interesting are the irreducible ones. More cannot happen.
So, thus, it is sufficient to know, well, and sufficient, depending what you, if you really want to do concrete calculations, there are a couple of things which I just basically swept away. There is the question, how do we find submodules, how do we do these base changes, how do we find the, well, there we can find the complement as a kernel, but if the group is bigger, this averaging process is actually rather complicated to do. So there is a lot in terms of concrete calculations which I left away. But at least theoretically for knowing, it's sufficient to know the irreducible representations. Okay. And that is basically chapter one of this book. He has two sections there where he's talking about tensor products of representations. That's essentially one way, if you have two representations, you can make a new one of them. In larger dimensions, we don't need this yet. Okay. So, yeah, and that gets us to chapter two, and that is character theory. So, what I actually didn't say last time is, you might ask, why on earth are we looking at such homomorphisms? I can give you, well, at least two answers. One is, in general, if you do mathematics, you don't just study objects, you study maps between the objects. The theory of the real numbers is not that enormously interesting on its own. But if you start looking at functions from the real numbers to the real numbers, you get enormously much happier. So we are looking at functions from groups to groups of matrices. Okay, the other answer is, it seems to be that studying groups is at least moderately difficult, in particular if we want to do concrete calculations. What are the things where we can do calculations reasonably easily? There is basically one area of mathematics where you can calculate everything exactly and easily. And that is linear algebra. And indeed, if you have anything where you are guaranteed, or at least as far as mathematics is known today, if you have anything where you can calculate things exactly, correctly, quickly, and so on. Essentially, it might be with some decorations, but it's in some way goes back to ideas of linear algebra. And that's frankly why linear algebra is the one topic where if you pick an arbitrary faculty member, you ask, are you an expert in linear algebra? They will say, yes, I am. I mean, with any other course, you will find people who will happily deny ever having anything to do with it. Linear algebra, everyone uses. And linear algebra, yeah, so this is here. So the hope is to say, can we use linear algebra techniques and do linear algebra calculations to find out something about groups? And so let's, for example, look at actions on vector spaces. I have already some linear algebra. Now, a question which could come is, we have seen every representation is a direct sum of irreducible representations. So, someone comes and hands you a representation and asks you what irreducible representations are in there. How can you do this? I said, well, I didn't really show you how to do it. Character theory basically tries to reduce
the calculation or tries to reduce the problem of calculating what these are the constituent irreducible representations of a representation R to a question of linear algebra, of decomposing a vector in a basis, essentially. And it turns out even nicer, it's not just an arbitrary basis, it's an orthonormal basis. So we don't need to solve a system of linear equations, but we just need to calculate their products. That's as nice as it goes. Right, so what we want is something where, yeah, let's just look back at how does such a representation look like. Let's say we have a direct sum, so we have a representation which has this form. And we want to have something, well, that something shouldn't be much, so let's try just a number. And we want that it behaves nicely, let's say addition, because I want a linear structure with this bit and this bit. Well, there is one property, one matrix thingy, which has that property, and that's the trace, right? The trace of this matrix is the trace of this, plus the trace of this. And therefore, we are taking the trace. Okay, at this point, this looks as naive as possible. Well, you don't have anything better to do there. That's why we are taking the trace. And it is one of the miracles that, or at least I feel this is a miracle, that things work out nicely. That this indeed gives us the things which we want. Yeah, you've seen, right? Trace is just the sum of the diagonal entries. It's even easier than to determine if the matrix is not diagonal is a mess. The trace is regardless what shape the matrix has, it's the sum of the diagonal entries. You don't need to do much. So, right. Definition, let row which goes from G to the general linear group over some vector space be a linear representation. The character associated to this representation character is a function chi rho, nothing to do with Egypt, but just because it's associated. Chi for character and rho because the representation was called rho, which should be a function which goes from the group to the complex numbers. And it's defined in the following way: an element little, G is mapped to the trace of the matrix associated to row of G. Well, I didn't write the matrix. You could talk about the trace of a linear operator by saying choose a basis, write down the matrix, and then one property of the trace is that it is invariant under matrix similarity or invariant under base changes. Okay. So that's the character of this representation. I will do examples just a bit later, but first get just a few properties, because then the examples become much easier. Okay, so character just says I take the representation, I don't care about what the whole matrix is. I just care about the trace of the matrices. There is, so far, the only argument which is saying this is something plausible to do is that it behaves nicely with this kind of direct sum decomposition. Otherwise, okay, and it gives me just a number. A number is a nice, easy thing. It doesn't give me something more complicated. Okay. Yeah, so what actually
since I started early, that might as well be a point where I stop and do the properties next time. And basically these characters are things people look at for describing groups. And as far as this combinatorics course is concerned, I think Dr. Betten is looking at tableaus and certain properties there, and there is a connection that a combinatorial process gives these characters of the symmetric group. So that's where it ties in to the later stuff. But what we'll do on Friday is just a little bit more about properties of these characters. Okay, yeah?
So to recap, today we showed that we can always get a representation of that form. What do you call that form?
It would be a direct sum of irreducible. And I mean, the form is in some way that depends on a basis. If I'm just talking about subspaces and so on, then this isn't even a special form. The special form only comes up once I need to choose basis for writing down matrices. Mm-hmm. We have seen every representation is a direct sum of irreducible subrepresentations.
Yeah.
And if you like, prefer to write down matrices, it's saying you could choose a basis such that your matrices all simultaneously have this form.
And each of those stars is like a sum.
Would be a smaller, for every group element I have such a matrix.
Yeah.
So every star would be a smaller matrix, and if I take the map from the group to only this upper smaller matrix, that is a representation. Mm-hmm. And that is a representation because these matrices just multiply this bit with each other and multiply this bit with each other. Mm-hmm.
Something about cosets in the group, right? If an element is we can't say anything about the elements in the group that get mapped to the same, that they sort of get projected down to the same point in the subspace.
Well, in the the group elements are not mapped to the space, they are mapped to linear transformations of the space. Right? So you could ask the question and say, when are two elements under a particular representation mapped to the same linear transformation? And then their quotient must lie in the kernel of that linear transformation. Mm-hmm. So both group elements lie in the same coset of kernel.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
So, yes.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much. Or any other. Sorry, I didn't want to cut off if there is another question. No. Okay. Thank you.